attitude. We are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
The independence case is a powerful one.
Another future is possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Nathan Yule, the director of Progressive Britain, Labour to Win, and editor of a new book that has only recently been released, Rethinking Labour's Past. Welcome to the podcast, Nathan.
Thank you very much for having me, Will.
It's great to have you on. Now, in regards to the book, the first question that I'd like to ask is, what made you decide to create the book, to edit the book and to contribute to it?
It's a very good question. Best place to start. There are three reasons, really. So the first, and it's a pretty prosaic one, it became my lockdown project. Mm-hmm. So the genesis of this book dates back to April 2020. So hopefully most of you would have banished how dreadful we all felt at the time. But it was right in the middle of that first lockdown. And actually, I was sitting at my computer waiting for the results to be announced in the leadership contest when Keir Starmer won the Labour leadership, either the 4th or the 5th of April. And on my Twitter feed, there popped up a link to a blog by the historian David Edgerton. Now, David Edgerton, I think, is one of the senior historians at King's College London, the author of a recent book on building the British nation. And David essentially wrote an article asking his readers to use what he assumed would be the election of Keir Starmer as an opportunity to re-engage and take a much better, more realistic understanding of Labour's history, and to ask Labour politicians and members to use that as a platform for a more realistic approximation of where Labour should be going in the future, which basically just got me thinking, which leads on to the second and third points. It got me thinking along factional lines in the first instance. I mean, for those of you who don't know, Progressive Britain was founded last year in 2021 by the effective merger of Progress, which is the organisation I've been leading since 2019, and Policy Network, which was the third way think tank set up 20 years ago to celebrate third way politics as espoused by Tony Blair, Bill Clinton, and the bogeyman that has now become Gerhard Schroeder in recent days because of Ukraine. But essentially, I think we decided after Keir's election, it was time to sort of press the reset button, if you like, and to rethink how we did progressive politics and policymaking in party. And I think one of the things I was thinking about that at that point 2 years ago was essentially how over the course of the 2010s, the left wing within the Labour Party and without the Labour Party had basically made much of the running in terms of intellectual discussion, policy debate, and actually in terms of owning Labour's history. So David's article really struck a chord with me, and it got me thinking. Now, originally, this project was going to be, I think, 6 or 8 long form, i.e. 2,500 word blogs that we were going to post on what was then the Progress website. But things kind of snowballed. I spoke to a number of academics and a number of politicians to see what appetite there would be for the book. And quite frankly, before I knew it, within about 3 or 4 months, we had a contract with Torus and Bloomsbury, but then also had like upwards of 20, 25 academics who were really interested in taking part in the book. And I think I just have to say big shout out to all of them, is because they undertook this work and they did the research and wrote their contributions in the middle of lockdown at a time when universities were going through a certain amount of tumult as well. So essentially, yeah, it started off, it was something for me to do. It was a political point about actually re-engaging with our history. But then also, like I've said, it's part and parcel of actually thinking about what progressive Labour politics looked like in the 2020s and under Keir Starmer's leadership. And it was also an attempt by going through the various stages of Labour's history to start re-engaging with our relationship with contemporary society. And I think one of the hopes I have of the book is that there is some insight across all the chapters that we can take on board as we're thinking about a forward-thinking policy offer for the country this year and next.
Yes, absolutely. And I just want to focus to begin with on one of the the first essay, the one after your introduction, which is Ben Jackson's The Disenchantment of the Labour Party. One of the things that I found particularly interesting in Ben's piece was his comments in relation to Ramsay MacDonald, in terms of how Ramsay MacDonald has, since pretty much the 1930s, been dismissed as a pariah to the Labour movement, and yet he had such a founding part in the formation of the Labour Party and Labour's very early successes. Do you think that now, given that there is such a distance from MacDonald, that there's going to be more of an attempt to see him as a perhaps a figure that was pivotal to the Labour Party and one that deserves perhaps more credit than he has received in the recent past?
The short answer, I think, probably should be yes. Mm. I think 2022 is quite a pivotal year. It's the 100th anniversary of the 1922 general election, which is crucial for the Labour Party, because it was in 1922 that the Labour Party first became the main opposition party, eclipsing the Liberals that year, and then using it to leapfrog into the first minority government in 1923-24. So it's a good period, it's a good time to start thinking about what that legacy might be. I mean, the only caveat there would be is that actually that world of the early 1920s is now so alien to the world of the 2020s. On one level, it might make it easier for us to take a slightly more sober and more objective view of his works. But I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, MacDonald is actually the crucial figure in that first 25-year period of the Labour Party, because quite frankly, if it wasn't for his continuing efforts in various roles as secretary of the PLP, as chairman of the Labour Party, then as the first prime minister, I mean, he literally knitted together different traditions and different isolated Labour parties and sects, almost, if you will, of what was then ethical socialist thought, and brought them together to help form what became the modern Labour Party. So I think, yes, his position is absolutely crucial. I think also it depends on how tribal a viewpoint I think we have on the Labour Party, because I think that tribalism has always come into play, because Ramsay MacDonald then went into bed and formed the national government in 1931, he was cast out forevermore. And I think he was obviously the main bogeyman of the next 40, 50 years of the Labour Party's lifetime, to the extent that even in the 1970s, you see there are figures on the left, and actually not that far on the left, actually using his name almost akin to Judas to accuse Quislings in the Labour Party of doing a Ramsay MacDonald. I think we've definitely moved on past that. Because if nothing else, most people would now look at you quizzically and not really understand what you're talking about. But I think yes, there is definitely a case to go back and actually saying that the Labour Party would not have existed in the way it did if it hadn't been for MacDonald's sort of key role in building those foundations.
Mm. And one of the next essays in the book is Richard Carr's essay on the Democrats and the Labour Party and the comparisons between the Democrats and Labour. I mean, how far do you think that you can make comparisons between the Democrats and Labour? Because in some ways, the Democratic Party has obviously been somewhat more successful than the Labour Party. But also there are some sort of key differences between the Democrats and Labour. Do you think that there are those sort of like comparison points? And what sort of comparison points do you think that there are between the Democrats and Labour?
I think the key issue for me of Richard Carr's essay, and for listeners out there, I mean, and Richard takes three episodes in the 30s, the 40s, and the 1960s, and interrogates the relationship of interesting figures, sort of John Strachey in the 30s. So John Strachey was a Labour MP turned communist who then came back to the Labour Party. Mary Agnes Hamilton, who had been a pacifist campaigner within the Labour Party, and then Roy Jenkins in the 50s and 60s, MP, future Home Secretary, Chancellor Exchequer, and then leader of the SDP at that point. And actually, like I said, he interrogates their relationships with various figures in the United States Democratic Party, and actually makes the case that actually that their relationships or their exposure to Democratic politics in the US had a fundamental effect on their politics and their policies. I think for me, the interesting thing about the Democrats is not necessarily that there is a like-for-like comparison for most of the period, for most of the 20th century, but it is actually the idea of what the Democratic Party of the United States potentially could represent, and the attractiveness of that to the Labour Party, I think, is one thing that we should not dispel. I mean, essentially, Rich is arguing is that for both Strachey and Hamilton, their exposure to what was sort of the New Deal in the 30s, and then Roosevelt's wartime administration in the 1940s, made them reconsider views they'd had, in particular about non-intervention and pacifism in the face of Nazi Germany in the 1930s and going into war in the 1940s. And again, I mean, this is a much more tried and tested story, I think. He shows how Roy Jenkins' relationships with figures like leading intellectual figures like John Kenneth Galbraith in the 50s had quite an impact on his liberalizing agenda as Home Secretary in the 1960s. All of which I think is a fair point. But if we take that further and move beyond the scope of what Richard wrote in that essay, there definitely has been something, I think, in the last 50 years. Like I said, it's about the promise of what US Democratic politicians can offer at their best that has been fundamentally attractive to the Labour Party, in large part, I think, because it has been shorn of some of the more rigid class identities that Labour itself had at that time. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, he's much maligned at the time, but look at a figure like President Johnson, Lyndon Baines Johnson, LBJ. Now, in large part, I think his, from an academic and a literary point of view, his reputation has been restored somewhat by the Leviathan that is the multi-part biography of LBJ by Robert Caro, the last volume we're still waiting for. But it basically goes to show that the immense potential and the impact of the new society reforms of the 1960s, much more so than anything that Kennedy put into place in his short presidency in the early 1960s, has a long-term and lasting effect on the US society, and shows what sort of progressive liberal politicians can do in power if they've got the gumption and the ability to actually push their reforms through. And it sounds daft, I'm about to say, even despite Vietnam, but if one can look at LBJ's record and winnow it down, so you're looking at domestic as opposed to foreign and defence affairs issues. I mean, the power of the state and in the 1960s to actually bring forward the civil rights and the civil rights packages and other social packages in the 1960s is immense. So I think that continues to have a great draw on many members of the Labour Party. I mean, obviously go back 30 years, and I think the closer comparison that most people would make is the affinity between Blair and Clinton in the 90s. And the interesting thing there is that both of them took the same view, that they had to reconnect their parties with contemporary society and with a contemporary changed economy in the 1990s to make progressive politics in both their countries relevant again. And actually, as we know, both of them did that successfully.
Mm. And it's interesting as well. You touch upon being able to reconnect with the public there. And that's something that you very much saw in 1945 when Labour won its great landslide victory. And Steve Fielding focuses on that in his essay on the shifting significance of the spirit of 45. And what I found particularly interesting about Steve's essay was not just the way in which Clement Attlee in the 1945 government, obviously portrayed by historians as immensely significant, but also the way in which he discusses how particular figures on the left, for example, Ken Loach, took the spirit of 45 and perhaps presented it in a way that suited their own politics more than was necessarily historically accurate. I mean, it's a continual touchstone in the history of the Labour Party, isn't it, the 1945 election. What do you think it symbolises for people today? And do you think it symbolises the same thing for people across the Labour Party, or does it symbolise sort of different things for different factions?
I think I'm being utterly honest. I would question what actual factual meaning 1945 has to anyone. I think, yes, it was the fantastic landslide winning victory. Yes, it was a government that then won the peace in the UK after the Second World War. And yes, famously, it was the government that both founded the NHS and took the United Kingdom into NATO. But I think it largely has significance as a totem, as the sort of the almost mythological totemic aspect of what that government achieved. And in particular, as we all now know, when it comes to election time and we see those Labour leaflets, because normally there will be one saying that you've only got 24 hours to save the NHS. It's that sort of it's that totemic narrative importance of that government, because it did found the NHS, which I think many people, it's that old adage that it's the closest thing that the people in the United Kingdom now have to a religion. It's devotion to the NHS, which obviously has been reburnished in the past 2 years because of all the fantastic hard work that staff members and the NHS itself have put in over COVID. Other than that, I think we need to take a step back and take a view of how much of a cleaving moment 1945 actually was in terms of British history. I think you look at the Ken Loach film, you look at the spirit of 45, and it very much, there was a backwards projection from Loach's then outside the Labour Party left-wing position about the fundamental revolutionary nature of 1945. And using it as an attempt to say that this is something we can win again. And on some level, I think, yes, it is obviously one of the big bookending moments of modern British history. But there are definitely questions there to be asked about, is 1945 a change or a continuity moment in terms of what was going on with the British state? I mean, let's not forget that actually we'd had 5 years of total war by this point, and both the governments of the UK and the British people were used to a strong state putting all the power of the state behind its military goals. It was actually just a shift to ensure that actually, like I said, if we'd won the war, we had to win the peace, and it was part of a contract with the British people, if you like, that the state was then going to put all its muscle behind renewing a new social contract with the population as payment for the war years. Also, when you start looking at many of those big achievements of 1945, again, there is a question: were these big thunderclap moments, or were they, albeit sped up, a continuation of trends that had been ongoing since the 1920s in terms of social programs and provision that had been increased in piecemeal form by both Labour and, I think it's important to remember here, by Conservative governments? I mean, Neville Chamberlain obviously has got a lot of flack since 1938-39 during the Arch of Pisa. But actually, in terms of a social domestic programme, he was probably the most enlightened politician in the interwar era. And in fact, that many of the social programmes that we all take for granted were the had been put into place by Attlee and the Labour government in 1945, were in some ways, like I said, albeit accelerated, a continuation of the work that Chamberlain had put in before that. Yeah. And you wouldn't get, I very much doubt you'd get Ken Loach or anybody else arguing that they were the inheritors of Neville Chamberlain's, of Neville Chamberlain at any point soon. So you're right, it does depend which cut of history you take. I mean, the other area to look at, I think this is what animated Stephen Fielding for writing this in the first place, is that 1945, Attlee, Ernest Bevin, many of the other figures in that government were for decades held up as being traitors by the hard left in the Labour Party or left-wing extra-parliamentary parties, because we went into NATO, because it wasn't a proper socialist programme or proper socialist revolution that the country had entertained after 1945. So, yes, it's about accommodation and how you use history. And I think the last point on this is, with Boris Johnson number 10 at the moment, these questions of actually what is a truthful or a useful interpretation of history and how one clothes oneself in old clothes and stories of the past becomes a fantastically important one, because I think we are all aware of the fact that the Prime Minister has at times a sort of a tangential relationship to the truth when he's clothing himself in Churchill's pinstripe and bowler hat, maintaining he's the champion of the nation in the 2020s against Europe and other undesirables, when in reality we know the truth is far from it.
Mm. In terms of that strong state that you mentioned there, one of the things that I thought was particularly interesting in Glenn O'Hara's piece on Harold Wilson was not just the analysis of the 64 to 70 government, which of course a lot of people praise anyway, but also his analysis on the 74 to 76 period of office in which Wilson returned as Prime Minister, and which Glenn argues that, you know, things were still achieved then instead of it being retroactively seen as somewhat of a lame duck period. I mean, looking back at Wilson, he is a figure that does seem to sort of shift in terms of perception between, you know, different members of the Labour Party and historians as well. And Keir Starmer said that he famously said that if there was any Labour Prime Minister, previous Labour leader or Labour Prime Minister he wanted to embrace or to invoke, it was Harold Wilson. So do you think now that there is a sense that Wilson, both as a person and as a leader of a government, is being recognised more than he was previously?
That's an interesting question, if only because I think that's a question that sort of politicians and historians have picked at occasionally for the past 30 years. I'm old enough to remember the last time in the early 1990s, or the first time rather in the early 1990s, when sort of academics and historians were asking, is the time ripe for a revival in Harold Wilson? I think the argument has always been, and largely off the back of the publication of Ben Pimlott's biography of Wilson, which I think either came out in 1991 or 1992. Going off the point now, it was actually one of the main reasons why I became so interested in Labour Party history in the first instance. I mean, it's a remarkably well written book, and I would recommend any readers out there go and buy a copy. But the issue ends up being Wilson. I think participants in the Labour Party, be they activists or politicians or government ministers after 1997, have always found it quite difficult to look at Wilson and his period in office without being able to sort of discount what came afterwards. So Blair's view on Wilson, or rather Tony Blair's view on Wilson in the mid-2000s at least, was that essentially Wilson either failed or shirked from the hard tasks of modernisation of British industry and British society in the 60s and 70s, which then led us almost inexorably to what came in the 1980s and a much sort of the harsher winds of Thatcherism that blew through British society. I think, and actually from that post hoc view, it's difficult to argue with that. I mean, I'm not quite sure whether I think it's a bit too binary a reading to say that Wilsonian failure ultimately and automatically led to Thatcherite triumph. But then again, I was only born in, I was only three at the time that Margaret Thatcher came in. So I think I don't really have much of a, obviously have no cognizant memory of what went on. I think what I do think about Wilson is, and in particularly the 1970s, as you mentioned, and this is, I think, the question that is there, is whether now Britain, having made it through the vicissitudes of the 2010s, which I think we can all agree is the most turmoil-ridden decade that the UK has had since at least the 80s, if not the 1970s, is that does one have a more favourable or charitable view of Harold Wilson in 2020 than one did in 2010? Mm-hmm. So I would say that virtually most politicians in the 2010s have been failures. Both Cameron and May were failures. I think Ed Miliband and then Jeremy Corbyn were both failed in their task of taking the Labour Party into successful victories. I mean, we've lost 4 general elections on the bounce, which is not a fantastic record. But if you look at both the social and economic turmoil of the 2010s, I think I do have a slight more I do have more of a glimmer of appreciation for what Wilson achieved in the 1970s, A, by keeping the Labour Party the show on the road, by getting into government. I mean, in 1974, let's not forget, Labour was elected because actually it was deemed to be the most credible party in terms of providing social and industrial peace to the UK after what had been basically three and a half torrid years under Ted Heath and shocking levels of industrial instability. And also looking at other issues going on about what was essentially a civil war in Ireland, what was that first referendum on Europe. Now, Ireland notwithstanding, I'm not sure any UK government comes out of Northern Ireland with much credit or much grace in the 1970s. But actually, I think Wilson, having kept the Labour Party together, having worked his way around his renegotiations with what was then the European Community, and keeping the country in the European, what was then the European Community, it does put his achievements in a slightly different light.
Mm-hmm. We're coming to the end of the podcast, Nathan. It's been great to have you on, and I have one final question for you. If you could meet any person from the history of the Labour Party going back well over 100 years who you've not been able to meet, which person would you meet?
I'm going to cheat and give you 2 answers.
Okay.
One, who I kind of met, right? So the first would be Barbara Castle. Mm-hmm. And this is the person I kind of met. I said hello to her. So I think in my second or third week at university in 1995, Margaret Castle came to talk to the University Labour Club. And I was struck then about being in the presence of somebody who was an important figure from the Labour Party's history. But like I said, didn't have a chance to talk to her. And indeed, I think it would be fascinating to sit down, I've had a drink or discussion with her in her heyday. So Barbara Castle's the first. And I think Anthony Crossland would be the second. He's a figure I've always admired tremendously. And again, I think he is someone whose writings in the 1970s potentially could tell us more in the 2020s than we've... than we realise, bearing in mind that obviously that Crossland-like vision of society and way of paying our way through greater aspiration sort of has not necessarily been at the top of anyone's reading list for the last couple of years. So I think maybe it's time we unearthed our copies of Socialism Now and reread our Crossland and see what he had to say to us from a similar period of social unrest and economic turmoil.
Well, I think those are 2 fantastic answers and 2 very mighty figures in the Labour Party who I'm sure any of our listeners would like to have met if they had the opportunity.
Well, if I can interject,
yes.
And turn the table, who would you like to meet, Will?
Well, I would actually like to meet Ramsay MacDonald, because I think that, as we mentioned, you know, as you mentioned at the start, he was a figure who was enormously important to the history of the Labour Party, but also someone who went from being the illegitimate son of a farm labourer in rural Scotland to being Prime Minister. And I think that that's an incredible story, particularly in the era that he lived. So I think he would be someone who would be fascinating to meet and to talk to.
And also, I guess, speaks to one of the enduring sort of qualities and values of the Labour Party that seems to sort of hover in and out of fashion depending on who's the leader. MacDonald himself is probably encapsulates sort of that value of aspiration and social mobility in terms of the leader more than anybody else who's ever led the Labour Party.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good answer.
Absolutely. Well, thank you once again for coming on the podcast, Nathan. If people want to buy the book, where should they go to buy it?
So currently, and this sounds like a humble brag, the book is back in, the book sold out. The first printing of the book sold out within the first 10 days of it being published. I think we're recording this now on, what is it, the 4th of March. The second printing of the book should be available via Bloomsbury. And the third printing is on its way. So I think hopefully you should be able to buy the book in Bloomsbury as a special offer to listeners. We can give you a 35% discount on the book. So if you buy the book via the Bloomsbury website and tap in the discount code progressive35, you should get 35% off the book. Otherwise, it is available mostly online, I think. I'm not quite sure it's made into that many shops, but mostly online wherever you buy your books.
Fantastic. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.